welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the programme that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm very pleased to have with me today two guests. One is Dr. Ruth Farrugia and the other is Mr. John Rollet. Just a few words about my guests. Dr. Farrugia is senior lecturer in civil law in the Faculty of Laws here at the university. She studied at the university's Faculty of Laws and at the Mediterranean Academy of Diplomatic Studies. She also studied at the University of Strasbourg. And she is a former consultant to the Deputy Prime Minister, Minister for Social Policy, the Social Affairs Committee in Parliament and UN High Commission for Refugees. Dr. Farrugia was commissioned to draft the Children Act, Commissioner for Children Act and the Gender Equality Act. Dr. Farrugia is legal advisor to the Commissioner for Children and country expert to the Comparative European Family Law Commission and the Common Core in Family Law Group. She holds a number of international appointments, including Council of Europe expert for the Child Access to Justice Initiative and Violence Against Children Project. She has published widely in the field of family law, child law and human rights. Mr. John Rollet is a senior social worker qualified in the UK with the foster care team leader within Agencia Apoj. He has been in this post since 1996. Prior to this job, he worked in a children's residential home for 20 years, fulfilling different roles, including head of care, social worker, teacher, care worker. Since 1997, he has been a part-time lecturer at the university, lecturing on residential care. He was a board member on the Children and Young Persons Advisory Board for 13 years and for 2 years on the IFCO, the International Foster Care Organisation Board. Mr. Rollet worked on two important projects related to European and national standards for children in out-of-home care. At present, he is also Vice President of the National Foster Care Association in Malta. And I'd like to add that he has come to talk to us today actually wearing that hat. Welcome to you both. I think as an initial question, perhaps, Dr. Farrugia, you could say in a general way, when we talk about children's rights, rights of the child, are we talking about legislation? Are we talking about moral issues? What exactly are we talking about?
Thank you for the question and thanks for the invitation. It's lovely to be here and to have the opportunity to talk about children's rights at all. Well, when we talk about children's rights, I'm obviously thinking of them within the legal context, but there's much more. You can't look at children's rights outside a bigger picture, outside the sociological picture, the psychological picture, the policy picture, because when we talk about law, we automatically expect policy to respond, or is it the other way around? That's the perennial question in law. What comes first? Is it policy or is it law? With children's rights, I think policy tends to come before the law. Law tends to lag behind, at least in this context, which is why we thought that a conference on foster care was a good idea, and particularly not just foster care in general, but the rights of the child in foster care. So child law talks about children within their family, and then it talks about children who can't stay, who can't live with their family. So children who are adopted, children who are placed in residential care, and of course children placed in foster care. And that's the focus of the conference.
We obviously have our own legislation, which you will be discussing and involves you in particular, but putting Malta in an international context, there is the UN Convention on Rights of the Child.
Where do we fit in? Where does Malta fit in with the international legislation and these conventions?
Well, Malta, as you rightly say, Malta has ratified the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. Although Malta has never taken steps to integrate the convention into domestic law. So although we're bound by the articles of the convention, you can't really cite them in court because they're not part of local law. I like to think that a judge would obviously take notice of the convention, but that's mainly because some of the other articles might have been transposed. And of course there are articles which haven't been transposed. There was an exercise carried out a few years ago now and an update to it regarding the gaps between what the convention expects and what we're delivering. So there are a series of items which can be seen from the recommendations of the Committee on the Rights of the Child, highlighting those issues where Malta's doing fine regarding children's rights and others where it's not doing so fine. Malta presented another report to the Committee on the Rights of the Child only a few months ago. It's available online, and there's a whole series of recommendations, some of which make reference to the initial recommendations made in 2000. The first report to the Committee on the CRC was in 2000. I defended that report a very long time ago, and there was a whole load of things that the committee was slightly concerned about. 12 years later, many of those concerns are unfortunately still there. Some things have been done. I don't want to be all negative. There have are things that have been done, but there are a substantial number that haven't.
What about the idea that we have to go along with European legislation? Do we have a chance to go beyond our legislation and take cases to Europe with regard to children?
Oh, this is lovely, thank you. Now, this is a question after my own heart. I spent a couple of years working on the Child Friendly Justice Project, which was basically just about that. And there are guidelines, Council of Europe guidelines, so not the 27, the 47. Council of Europe guidelines about access to justice for children. In real terms, how does this work out? We can talk about children should be able to have access to justice, but how does that really work in practice? And we who work with children know that it doesn't work in practice. I'm sure John has a lot to say about this. What's interesting about those guidelines, though, and about children being able to access justice, is that the EU has made the guidelines of Council of Europe its own. It's decided that these make a lot of sense. It likes these. And it wants its member states, the 27, to start making them work. And it said this in 2011. Whether that seeped through to local government and to people in general, and more particularly to children, is another matter. Again, we need to talk more about that.
Before I turn to Mr. Ollier, perhaps we can look at a few statistics, because I, in preparation obviously for this interview, I looked up a few statistics and I was actually quite interested to see, for example, what percentage children are within the Maltese population.
Yes, well, thank you for digging this up. the statistics that you're showing me are about a lecture that I gave quite a long time ago. So they're 2008 statistics. Actually, sometimes the statistics we have are not up to date, and that's another issue when you're dealing with children. There are no disaggregated statistics about children, or very few, and that causes a problem when you're trying to do research. But in general, we know that children are about a fifth of the population, 20%. So when we're talking about children's needs, children's rights, children's participation, that's a big chunk of people. How many children were born outside marriage? Does that make a difference? It makes a difference in terms of what access they have to some rights. They're obviously at a par with children born in marriage legally, but when we're talking about poverty issues, when we're talking about their parents' access to certain rights and responsibilities, what happens there? And in 2008, we had over 1,000 children born outside marriage. I know for a fact that this has gone up substantially. How many children are in primary school? How many children take exams? How many children don't take exams? Why don't they take exams? How many children live in residential care? quite a large number of children in residential care. 280 children in foster care.
280 children in foster care, which compared in 96 when we started foster care, we had only 29. So...
big jump.
We'll leave it in 5 years, because the statistics in 2008 were 160. So that's 120 extra. That's really close to doubling in 5 years. That's a real lot.
Last November, I was at a conference in Bulgaria organized by IFCO. We were told that we are the only country in Europe that we managed to triple the children in foster care, to find foster families. And that's a credit to us, Maltese families, due to the fact that compared with other countries where foster carers are paid and they see foster care sometimes as a job, here the Maltese families, they only get a very minimal remuneration for what they do, and we still get families coming over to the foster children. So that's, I think that's a credit to us Maltese, and we should be proud of that. Maltese and Gozatines.
Yes, that's extended to Gozo.
Because we
great.
Have a number of foster carers even in Gozo, so while some years back we didn't have.
Perhaps we can now have a look at how foster care works, because obviously we've spoken with Dr. Farajan in a general sense about children and children in various situations, but this conference is going to highlight particularly foster care. And obviously, Mr. Rolle, you've had a wide experience in this area. How does it work here in Malta, and is it any different really to how it works elsewhere?
I think it's different to the fact that, as I said, when it comes to recruitment, till now we're still finding foster families. Whilst if you go to the UK or other countries, although, as I said, the foster carers are paid, they still have the difficulty of recruiting foster carers. I think we have an advantage as regards even when we do awareness campaigns. For example, we were doing an exercise at the IFCO conference of how we should plan an awareness campaign, and we were saying that we have radio programs, half an hour, television programs, three quarters of an hour. They told us, you know, I mean, for us, it's impossible financially to do it. You know, so in that sense, the fact that we have the opportunity to use the local media, television, radio, and we're practically in people's houses, you know, through the media, that's a big advantage to us as an association, as an agency, that you can do that sort of awareness campaign. And most of our awareness campaign, we even get foster carers and young persons who were in foster care themselves, and they share the experience themselves. So that in itself, it's already something different from other places. As regards training and assessments of foster families prior to going into foster care, I think that's very similar, that what we use. Maybe one thing that we're really lacking is, and I think it could be due even to financial situations, that we would love to have ongoing training to foster carers, where, although this conference is part of the training of foster carers, and the fact foster carers, the next day they're going to have another morning for themselves, as regards contact training, how to do contact with birth families. That's our initiative as well, so that our foster carers have sort of the latest training, so that the standard of foster care as regards skills of foster carers will increase. But if we compare with that with the UK, for example, they have specific programs to foster carers, and they are even being sort of, they are being paid to go for the training. Whilst foster carers, you know, I mean, this is one of the issues. You know, I mean, even at the conference, we had people who came from the UK, their agency paid their traveling expenses to come to Bulgaria. So, for us over here, for our foster carers had to pay to go to Bulgaria. So even ourselves as foster care, as social workers, had to pay to go to the conference. So we're in the situation where we would love to do a lot of things, you know, which I know that we could get that sort of standard, because we've seen it even over the years now, that even the type of foster carers that we have, And that's another thing, that it's coming from the recruitment. You're having people coming from all over strata, you know, of society. Which for us, that's good as well, mm-hmm. because so that there won't be that gap between the child who is in need of foster care or with the foster care. So there's a balance that in itself even helps better to have, for example, parental contact. You know, whilst in the past it was more on, you know, I have a young person who's going to help the nuns and she falls in love with a child and I take him home and then I could afford to look after this child. Because, I mean, one thing which used to happen in the past, foster cares, they weren't even given the children's allowance. So we had people who really had the money to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying that the present foster care are getting paid, but there's a difference.
Sure.
You know, and I think that in itself, in the past, could have created this gap between the bird family and the foster cares.
I know that bird family is an expression, a professional expression that you use. It doesn't sounds a bit harsh, but I realize that what you mean. In fact, what would be the main reasons why these children would need to be in foster care?
I think there's differences in the sense that you might have children who their parents, they're passing difficult situations regarding, for example, their health and even their own mental health. So you have that scenario. But then you have scenario where kids are being literally abused in their homes. You know, being beaten. I mean, some stories, they're horrific. And in a sense, that's why sort of our issue is that you children who are coming foster care, they are traumatized. Some of them, they are traumatized even within the womb. The fact that you've got a person who's abusing drugs or any other toxic, you know, that we know today from research that these children, they're already, in a way, being abused. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they go through this abuse, this trauma, today we know that even it affects your own, you know, nervous system. So there are things that they link to each other, and we have to prepare to the foster case to understand why children act out this way, because there are certain things which maybe before we used to say, oh, he's naughty or he's got a temperament. But if you have a child who genetically is born with a harsh temperament, you know, but the type of parenting that this child needs, all right, is different, and you have to understand why he is acting that way, and maybe in a simple words, that you have children who have difficulty to regulate anxiety. You have children who are stressed. You have children who, they need, instead of they respond to stress, they react to stress. So you have to know, as a foster carer, how to respond to that. You know, so that it could be that because of stress, and this could happen, that you have a child who literally cannot regulate his anxiety, so he needs someone to understand, instead of shouting at the child or expecting the child to say to him, look, calm down, and you expect him to switch on or on like that, where there are other skills you have to keep in mind that you could do. And it could be not even saying a word. You know, even a touch could make a difference, you know. And I mean, these are things that we go into the training.
Sure.
We explain to
foster kids. It's a complex issue, isn't it?
It is very complex.
And it involves people who have different skills, I imagine. I mean, that you mentioned even discovering what happens to the child in the womb. Then you've got the social aspect, you've got the legal aspect. So it's so
beauty,
complex.
The beauty of it, though, I think, that it's very, very child-centered.
The whole aim and the whole practice centers around what the child needs. Rather than what one little box that you're supposed to fit into, which is very much what we tend to do in other scenarios. So I think that's one of the great strengths of foster care. Mm-hmm. Although, of course, there are other foster care situations, which John hasn't mentioned, possibly because we don't have them yet. Like, for instance, specialized foster care for children who are in conflict with the law. There have been a number of initiatives abroad where instead of placing children in a secure establishment or in prison, you place them with a specialized foster carer. It costs less and it's much, much more effective. Placing mother and child in foster care. If you have a teenage mother who's had a child and who can't live with her birth, I will use the same because I don't like natural, with her birth family. That's also a positive thing. You know, there's many other kinds of foster care. Obviously, for the foster care units to be able to do this sort of thing, they need much more in the way of resources and funding.
Definitely. The thing is the situations that Ruth is mentioning, you need, first of all, a lot of experience. You cannot expect a person who has no experience in foster care to just start with this. So, because you're talking about really complicated behavior of children, which the way you respond, it's different. You mentioned in my introduction, I mean, I remember my experience when I went for the first time at St. Patrick's as a 20-year-old. At that time, the government decided that the young persons who were living at the approved school, which used to be sort of the prison at that time, they send these 12 kids to St. Patrick's. And I remember the shock that everyone had, you know, because you're dealing with children who came to St. Patrick's because of difficulties that they had at home, whilst you're mixing young persons who were in touch with criminality. You have a completely different way of working. And I remember they came in summer and it was okay because there were no problems. We used to go swimming. When we came to go into class, for example, it was unbelievable. For example, I don't know how they got knives in their hands. So in a sense, you have to really be prepared. That's why I was saying in the beginning that we have to have a really structured training for foster carers. And another thing which I think it's a good idea, the fact, I mean, I worked on for nearly 3 years on standards, European standards and even local standards. I mean, it would be really beautiful if you had training using the standards that we have, that we foster carers need to acquire, and plan a training program around those standards so that those standards will be met. Even through my experience from abroad, I believe that we could do these things in Malta. And it's a matter of really sitting down, planning these issues. And I believe still that we have even local resources that we could use. Apart from the contacts that we have from abroad, I think even local professionals that we have could help us out in this.
One thing you mentioned before, which I'd like to pick up on very quickly, because we don't have much time, the idea of hearing the children's voice. These are minors. How do you go about hearing the voice of minors?
Well, it depends what you're hearing, in which context you're hearing them. I mean, if you're hearing them in court, in a court setting, and a decision's going to be taken that affects their present or future well-being, then you should have the decency to listen to them. That's as crudely as I can put it. You'd never think of making a decision for anyone else without at least letting them know that you're going to make a decision about them. We do that all the time for children, ostensibly in their best interest, whatever that means. But I won't get started on that one. So, when we're talking about child participation, which is actually one of the main things that comes out of the CRC, of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, we need to be inventive and find ways of making sure children do participate. So, in the context of foster care, for instance, if they need to be placed or the idea is that it would be beneficial for them to be placed in foster care, well, then you need to listen to what children have to say about it. Listening doesn't mean necessarily doing what they want. I always liken this to adults. Adults in court will say what they want. The judge doesn't necessarily go along with it, but he does, or she does, listen to what they have to say and give them the opportunity to say what they have to say, because I've interviewed quite a few children in research who are really angry at not being asked. You know, I do have an opinion. Please listen to me, or don't make decisions about who I'm going to live with, where I'm going to stay, without asking me. Don't make provisions regarding access, contact. In the foster care field, even more so, you know. You've placed me with a new family. Give me time to get used to this new family before setting up access arrangements with people that have probably done some really horrible things to me.
Just a last word about the conference itself. It's on the 26th of April. It's called the Conference on the Rights of the Child in Foster Care. I know that you've got a number of people already booked and you have an audience, but you did say that you, before we went on air, that you were interested that perhaps more students should come, and that they have a nominal fee, which apparently they can even get a rebate.
That's right.
On. So who could they contact if they wanted to come to the conference?
Well, the person to contact is James Bonici in the Faculty of Laws. His email address is james.bonici@um.edu.mt. I'm really excited about this conference. It started off because I really wanted a conference regarding foster care, and we just happened to have a visiting lecturer who was coming to share some very interesting comparative research about foster care legislation in Spain and in Malta. And I thought it would be a lovely idea to link up with an NGO, a university, academia, with NGO. And John was very enthusiastic too. And he provided a wonderful speaker, because Mr. Justice De Gaetano, who is now our judge at the European Court of Human Rights, is himself a former foster carer. And he's going to talk about the rights of the child in foster care, which is brilliant.
Well, that's great. Thank you very, very much, both of you, Dr. Ruth Farrugia and Mr. John Rollet, for coming to talk to us about children in foster care and about this conference in April. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.